Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and joining us now, CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, stock market at a record. Do we celebrate or do we worry?
Huh. I don't know if those are my two choices, really. Like, I want another choice, which is we should take it. We should be certainly pleased. But I hate to have the idea that we're celebrating. I always think the stock market and investing in general, this is a means to an end. We're trying to get to some goal in the future. So that might mean that you're saving money for your kids' college education. More likely, you're using the stock market as a means to help beat the rate of inflation so that you can retire when you want to.
Now, for a lot of people, the goal is just let's not run out of money before I die. And I noticed that half the new jobs in 2018 went to workers 55 and older. Now, is that because they just love working or because their retirement funds are short?
I think it's probably the latter, although I will say that I think more and more people are starting to realize that their longevity, you know, the idea that your retirement could last for, you know, three decades might be encouraging people not to, to stay in the workforce or return to the workforce, because that's an awful long time to do whatever you think you're going to do at home. That said, we do know that older workers are not or have not saved enough overall in order to just have the choice to retire. And that's something that I read about in a new paper, and we've talked about it many times, but there's some research out from the folks at Boston College. They were trying to figure out, well, why is this happening? You know, like, this is not that a whole generation of people is a bunch of deadbeats. What's going on? And they find that the two biggest factors that contribute to the low level of retirement savings are the, what they call the immaturity of the system, meaning it hasn't been around that long. Just, you know, 401ks, they all came about in sort of the 80s. And also that there is a lack of universal coverage, that throughout this time, these decades, we have found that many workers didn't have access to retirement accounts, and it was very difficult to save for them. And you, those two big factors, along with the fact that you can actually take money out of retirement plans pretty easily, and that we've got big fees in a lot of these plans, and they conclude with the typical older worker having less than 100 grand in retirement assets instead of closer to 365,000, which you would have had under a system in which workers were participating throughout their careers.
Now, how much of that is eaten up by fees? I know that sometimes surprises people when you see at the end of the year just how much your brokerage account charged you.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think fees are a part of it. I think that fees have come down on many of these plans as education has increased, and that's been terrific. I think the bigger issue is, again, that a lot of people didn't have access to these plans, that there's this thing called leakage. We're not talking diapers here, gang, I promise, which means that when you look at your retirement account, it's pretty easy to get to the money there. So, you know, compare yourself if you've got a 401k to maybe a friend who's got a pension, a teacher friend of yours. And you know what? It's really hard to get to a pension early. You really have to fulfill your time, pay into the system, and you can't miss it. Whereas with a 401k, you can cash out when you change a job, which we don't like people to do, but they do it quite often. You can get money out of that plan while you're working. Maybe it's a hardship withdrawal, or maybe you're under the age of 59 and a half. You want to help your kid pay for college. You can take that money out of your retirement account. You've got loans. And I think that part of it is much more substantial than the fee part. But overall, what we know is that when people have plans offered through work, they participate in greater numbers and they tend to save more over their work lives.
So what would a reasonable fee be for a plan that has, as you, in your example here, something like $300,000 in it?
Well, a reasonable fee would be, it used to be that plan fees would be a couple percent. Mm-hmm. And now what we know is that if you can keep the fees down below 1%, that's a good plan. That's a pretty affordable plan.
And so if those of us who are a little older could offer any advice to people who are a little younger and just starting out, it's whatever you do, join that plan and save like crazy, right?
Yeah, or save to the best of your ability. And like for those employers out there, a lot of plans are, you can find more affordable plans. You've got a small business. You can go to one of these online platforms. They are really reaching out to small businesses to make retirement plans affordable. It really should be something that is standard in every single package.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Imagine you have arranged for an Airbnb, and then a few hours before you arrive, the landlord essentially calls up and says, well, somebody stuffed something down the toilet. We can't rent it to you, but we have this substitute place, and here's the address. And you go there, and boy, are you surprised. It happened to Ali Conti, who writes this article for Vice.com. This turned out to be more than just a one-off. This turned out to be apparently a systematic Airbnb scam. So just let's go over what happened to you, the sequence of events here, Ali.
Sure. Like you described, I got to Chicago with my luggage and was told, you know, you can't check into the place that you booked, but the good news is we have a different property that's much bigger. I guess it was implied that it was supposed to be nicer because it was bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Get to the place. It's a complete flop house. 8 or 9 beds, no other furniture, no cookware, holes punched in the walls. No one should ever be staying there. It's dirty and yeah, it's not a place that you want to go. The people that were running the scam were doing this to people in at least 8 different cities.
You saw this same kind of lure at a number of properties?
Yeah, so they had the same formula, an appealing looking couple that was like taken from a stock photo website. A lot of the properties were described using the same language, appealing to people that were particularly staying for bachelor or wedding parties, like large groups that are unlikely to book a hotel because, you know, booking 9 hotel rooms is expensive.
And then they have no intention of ever selling you anything that resembles the picture. They will simply refer you to some flop house. You have any idea how often this happens?
I can't speak to the scale, but I can say just from my own reporting that there were at least 100 listings operating this way on Airbnb as of a month ago.
Now, when you sign up for Airbnb, nobody actually comes out to vet you or to ensure that you're actually being truthful in your ads. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a system that's built on trust, which might have made sense when the company started and the people using it were, you know, it was a small number of kind of tech evangelists. But now that this has got 7 million listings on it, it's almost unrealistic to imagine how anyone could be vetting that many listings. The company did announce that they have made plans to verify all 7 million listings by the end of 2020. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no like specifics as to, you know, how they plan to do that.
Yeah. I've used it a couple of times, and like you say, it seemed in the early years, everybody was in the same mindset. You know, there's a certain vibe to it, and everybody understood this is a great idea. But there's always a few who can spoil it. It seems to me that it reminds us that as annoying as regulations are, sometimes you have to do it because you can't always trust people.
Yeah, like I said, this was probably a pretty good idea when it was a small number of people using it. But anytime you scale to the degree that Airbnb has scaled, people are going to find ways to take advantage of the rules. And, you know, just bad actors are going to creep in and try to manipulate people. I think Airbnb needs to rewrite some of its rules, particularly regarding refunds. I found a lot of flaws in that system during my reporting that, you know, they're heavily biased toward the hosts and therefore incentivize scammers. And they need to kind of work out those loopholes.
And so while we're waiting for them to work out those loopholes, do you have any tips that people can use to avoid getting scammed?
You know, scrutinize the people that are leaving reviews for your host. What I found was the scammers were making many different fake accounts and reviewing each other. So just because there's a 5-star review doesn't mean it's been left by a real person. Click on that profile. See if it looks fake. Look at the image. Does it look like a stock photo or like a real person?
And there's no way to really find out who is doing the scamming. They are able to remain anonymous?
I mean, I was able to track down the person who scammed me, but I don't know that it's realistic for most people who don't do this for a living to dig through property assessor records in order to get a refund. I don't think that's the thing that most people would be willing to do. It took a lot of time.
So you tracked your scammer down. What was that meeting like?
Well, I called the guy, and the person who picked up the phone claimed his name was Patrick, which is not the name of the scammer. But he seemed to show a lot of interest in why I was calling and what I was writing for someone who wasn't the scammer. I'll just say that.
Yeah. And?
Yeah. Well, after we talked, they started changing some of the listings. Immediately, the rental company that the guy owned took its website down. I can tell that they didn't expect to actually ever be confronted.
Really? So it is possible, is what you're saying?
It is possible, but Airbnb should be doing this. I shouldn't have to, launch a criminal investigation basically to figure out how to get a refund after getting scammed. File a police report if this happens to you. I think people often don't realize that this rises to the level of criminal fraud. Like, you have every right to file a police report.
Another good
And
idea. Yeah, that's right. It is fraud. And will the police investigate this, or is this one of those nuisance things where they don't think they'll ever get a conviction?
well, I've been in touch with the FBI since the article came out, and they're looking into it. And I've also gotten a phone call from the fraud unit at the Chicago Police Department, and they've encouraged me to tell people to file police reports if this has happened to them. And I agree, they should.
Ali Conti wrote a piece called "I Accidentally Uncovered a Nationwide Scam on Airbnb." It's advice.com. Ali, thanks very much. Good luck with your next booking.
Thanks a lot.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Here we are, a week into Eastern Standard Time, and according to the latest research, you are probably still feeling the effects. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, what is the latest research about this time change twice a year?
Dave, doctors are actually calling for an end to daylight savings time. Why would they do this? Well, they're arguing that these annual transitions to and from daylight savings time actually misalign our biological clocks or our circadian rhythm, which we've talked about before. Some people think, well, it's no big deal. It's just twice a year that we make a 1 hour adjustment. But actually, it's really a misalignment of our biological clocks for about 8 months out of the year. Daylight savings time transitions can affect a number of our different brain functions, including alertness and energy levels. It also affects a number of other physiological aspects of our body as well. So it's actually harmful. And so now doctors are actually asking for it to be changed.
So what is it that's new about this latest study? The doctor sounded pretty alarmed. And they also point out that if the whole idea of switching the clocks was to reduce energy, it really doesn't work that way.
It really isn't much. So doctors are looking at it from a different point of view. They're saying, well, what about it being a health issue? Now, there have been studies done in the past that assess the health impacts of these annual transitions, and they found that the effects of sleep loss actually build up over years. And daylight savings time essentially reduces an individual's exposure to the bright morning sunlight, which is really critical for helping us synchronize our biological clocks. So doctors have found that disruption of this synchronizing process actually leads to an increased risk of heart disease, stroke, and other health conditions. We're actually realizing there may be more of a cost in terms of human health and well-being than the actual energy savings that we're supposedly getting from having daylight savings time.
So can you feel it? I mean, how should we be feeling a week into this?
Well, the thing is that people have had problems with poor sleep. We know that it's actually associated with diseases that are chronic diseases that may not be something that you feel acutely. But it's the bigger problems, like its association with obesity and diabetes. In fact, what we've learned is that we express our genes differently when we have sleep disruption. So it's actually what we don't understand is the effect of it on people with good health, but we're starting to understand that people who have bad health can actually be severely impacted by it. And we're also learning that over time, there's a number of long-term health effects. So there's, as I mentioned, obesity and diabetes, stroke risk, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and people have even developed kidney failure. And so there's a whole host of problems that are long-term are associated with this. And so when we think about it in terms of actual financial costs, the question gets raised is there a greater financial cost paying for the health problems that are generated as a result of the transition in time and light? Or are we actually saving money by consuming less energy? But the key thing is that we understand that these disruptions in our sleep phase are significant. They have significant long-term health effects. And as a result, doctors are now starting to look at it and say, what's the point?
Yeah, right. So how can you treat this on your own? Is it like jet lag?
So the ways that you can treat it are because you're getting exposed to less sunlight, you can get a lamp that emits UV rays in the appropriate wavelength so that you get more exposure. There are some people who have seasonal affective disorder, which is a slowing of your metabolic rate and an overall depressive physiologically depressive syndrome and mentally depressive syndrome as a result of inadequate sun exposure. And so people who are sensitive to this will be more affected by daylight savings time and need to be treated with a UV lamp. And there are other people who are less affected by it, and they may not feel it and maybe don't need to do anything. But again, we're still disrupting our circadian rhythms. We're out of whack with our circadian rhythms. And it's the long-term health effects that are really the biggest issue.
So if asked to testify by Congress in favor of getting rid of daylight saving time, you would eagerly go.
Yeah, I mean, even long before I was a doctor, when I was a little kid, I don't think I ever loved daylight savings time. I'm not sure anybody loves daylight savings time. So, yeah, I would eagerly jump in front of Congress and try and give the best possible scientific evidence that's out there to dissuade them from keeping it. I think it's far simpler to just keep the same time going all year round.
Yes. And you wouldn't insist on a subpoena first. You would just go voluntarily.
I would not insist on a subpoena first. I would go voluntarily. And I wouldn't tweet about it either.
You are a true American, Dr. Gordon Cohen. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen and Chris, and here is Hannah Scott. A gun tax proposal up for a vote at the Tacoma City Council tomorrow. What's this about?
So Tacoma's gun tax proposal is modeled after Seattle's gun tax. It would tack on $25 to every gun sale in the city, along with an ammo tax, 2 cents a round for .22 caliber or less, and 5 cents a round for all other ammunition sold at retail. The estimated $30,000 a year that this tax would raise would be used for violence prevention programs, something backers say the city needs more of, with a 37% increase in gun-related crimes between 2014 and 2018, and 19 of the city's 22 murders this year involving guns. Gun retailers have said it will drive them out of business or push them out of the city, and there were other concerns from business owners like Scott Dover, who's CEO of Arrow Precision, a gun manufacturer in the city.
This tax will not only affect, you know, over-the-counter sales, but eventually will affect parts and components. It'll just literally put us out of business if we were to stay in Tacoma with this type of tax.
And with 450 employees at that company, Dover says that's something that the city council should care about. Gun retailers that spoke to Cairo 7 TV also had concerns.
The store will be closed by January 1st. We will close the doors. So there'll be 11 people that are unemployed.
And then there are these complaints, much like those we heard in the lead-up to Seattle's gun tax.
What's happening is the city council basically just hates guns, and they want to deprive citizens of their Second Amendment rights. And by taxing their Second Amendment rights, they're making it inconvenient.
Now, a vote was scheduled a couple of weeks ago until that morning.
And I, along with all of my colleagues, want as much as anything to reduce gun violence in our city. I just think we need more information and a little bit more dialogue.
Perhaps having so many different fly-in amendments moving around and not knowing what, if any, urgency there is to this, save the idea that we want to make the best possible step forward, that it might behoove us to take some time to ferret through these various amendments to make sure that what we are actually trying to do actually makes a measurable difference.
So concerns were raised about whether that large gun tax manufacturer would be taxed on parts, whether money would go where the money would go, and the fact that this tax would only raise an estimated $30,000 a year led some to question what really the sense of urgency was. And the backer of this initiative had this to say.
There's been an urgency in this room and in this country for decades. The kids that died in my neighborhood this past summer sure wish that we would have taken greater urgency. So I get that there's things that we want to work through, but I just want to be really clear that it's been a strategy and a tactic of the National Rifle Association to make sure that there's always a reason to raise a question in your mind for why we shouldn't act today, because we got to protect somebody and their right to pick up a gun and kill somebody.
In that morning session, things got a little heated. In the end, they ended up punting that vote with a packed room. The city council room was overflowing that night, and they decided, because of various amendments that wanted to be added to it, that they would push it until tomorrow night, which is when they will are expected to vote on that. There's a series of amendments now on their agenda for tomorrow. One would be to use some of this money for a gun buyback program. Not a lot of details there. It's just a couple of sentences. Also, there's another to half this tax. So the it would be $12.50 instead of $25 a gun. And then the same with the ammo cents on the tax would be halved. and a couple of other ones. So we'll see how it goes tomorrow night.
So just a couple of questions here. Did the sponsors of the bill point to some data indicating that the gun deaths were caused by people who had just bought a gun legally at a gun shop?
No, not at all. Just, you know, you had your stats there on the murder rates that they do involve guns. And then they did point in the legislation to gun violence prevention programs helping to reduce gun violence just in a general sense.
Well, I mean, gun violence, it's not necessarily the gun that's violent. It's the person that's holding the gun. I mean, that's the argument I hear all the time. Do the cops not have enough money to track down and make sure that the usual suspects aren't getting easy access to stolen or underground firearms?
Well, and I don't know. I did not see that in the legislation or hear that come up. I will say this is various parts of the original ordinance discusses gang violence and things like that, which has been a big, big problem in the city of Tacoma. Mm-hmm. So some of this prevention programs that they're asking the city manager, if this passes, to come up and recommend would be to look at things like some of the programs we talked about earlier in the year, right? Restorative justice, getting in touch with those young people when they get guns, not so much focusing on where they get their guns, though. There's no safe storage component in Tacoma that I'm aware of, aside from what came with 1639.
Yeah. Look at it from the other direction. The gun dealers seem to be unanimous. The $25 per gun tax would put them out of business.
Most.
But I mean, an AR-15, my understanding is it costs about $1,200. If you've got $1,200, you've got $1,225, don't you?
Right, but that's the buyer, right? Not the person selling it. So,
just raise the price.
Well, but look, so, and that's the other part of this conversation. They also reference often that look at what happened in Seattle. Seattle, most of the gun retailers here are gone because of Seattle's tax. And the tax money that it brought in significantly goes down every year.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
If there are no gun dealers selling guns.
Right? That's the way it's going to go.
But that may be the object of this, right?
But it did do that. It did drive those companies out of the city. Mm-hmm. And then you're losing that, you know, that business tax too, that revenue. And if we're talking about $30,000 you're trying to raise from this tax, what's the point?
It's not just the money, right?
Not all. Yeah.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. And this one I'm going to dedicate to my daughter, Elliot. I didn't realize till this weekend that she listens every morning to the dose of kindness. You believe that?
I believe it.
I didn't know. She said, Mom, I listen to you every morning.
My kids used to listen. They thought every parent had their own radio station.
No, just a special few. So this one's for you, Elliot. When an emergency call comes in, paramedic Ivan Mazurkiewicz responds. But he's not your average paramedic. If there's a kid in his care, he doesn't just treat them medically. He treats them to a magic show. Why?
It breaks the ice. It takes down their wall. Their association of an ambulance is blood and needles. It can literally turn a kid's worst day into one of the best days.
In the last 5 years, he's responded to more than 4,000 emergencies, and it was tragedy that drove him to search for a way to better connect with kids. And that's when he realized that his boyhood love for magic might hold the key, so he started practicing.
I was saying that I had one and you had one, but in reality, I had how many?
Zero.
And you had how many?
Two. Three.
Wait, what? So I learned a couple coin tricks, and I was terrible with it. But you know, I didn't have to be good at it. I just had to be good enough for that kid, for one kid.
Of course, some calls are too critical for card tricks, but after he delivers a patient safely to the ER, he still takes the time to distract the child while at the hospital, too.
One time I was doing magic tricks in the ER, and I was doing it while they were starting an IV on the kid, and the kid definitely still felt the IV. But he was still interested in what I was doing more.
Dr. Andrew Stevens, an emergency medicine physician, said it makes his job easier.
What really matters maybe isn't the medicine, it's how you treat people. And he just reminded me of that.
And for Ivan, what he does, it's just simple.
All I want to do is be good at my job. And if it means me finding another way to be a better paramedic, which is doing magic tricks for kids, by all means, I'm going to do that.
Those are the kind of people you want working with kids, right?
Yes, indeed. Time for the Sports Insider. Stacy Ross from 710 ESPN Seattle. Did you get a chance to see any of the Sounders match, Stacy?
I did not. No.
We happen
I
to
watched
be,
maybe we 5 minutes, but...
Well, if you're watching the right 5 minutes, though, it was darned exciting. We were in a pizza place just getting a bite to eat at about the, what would it have been, the 50th minute, and then... At the 57th minute was that crazy deflection goal from...
That's the thing. If you watched in, like, after the first hour, solid.
Here's an even more amazing thing, though. Last Tuesday, I talked with soccer superfan Jason Rance. And I said, okay, what do you think the score of the MLS Cup game is going to be? And here is the actual recording of his actual answer.
Yes, the Sounders are 100% going to win. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with 3-1.
3-1, which is exactly what it was.
Not as hard as predicting a football game.
Is Jason a witch?
No.
This is, I'm very suspicious. Well, so this is strange.
I just went back with James, our producer, to check, and it was last Tuesday. It's a certified recording. We have the chain of custody, so maybe he is. So that's two championships for the Sounders, three for the Storm, one for the Seahawks, one for the Sonics, a Stanley Cup for the Metropolitans. Of course, that goes back a long way.
And no, count it. Count it, Dave.
And they none for the Mariners.
Right. And none for the Mariners. But we got a parade on Tuesday. And those are fun, right? Did you go to the Seahawks parade?
No, and I remember, so at the time I was working at the spot where I asked, we had two like younger bosses. They didn't seem younger at the time. They were like in their late 30s, but I was probably 21. So when you're 21, anyone over 30 is like 95.
Right.
And I asked them if I could go to the parade, and they both were like, oh, you know, we're going to be out, so it's really tricky. And then I found out they went to the parade.
See?
Never forget.
Well, maybe this can be your parade tomorrow.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm really, really happy for Sounders fans. There is no greater pressure I face than, as someone who did not grow up watching soccer, trying to make Sounders fans not angry at me when I talk about soccer.
I'll just say congratulations.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm so happy for Sounders fans. They're intense. Best fans in the world. Love this team.
Yeah.
And then I just hold my breath and hope that that's enough.
Well, you can't ignore 69,000 plus people packing CenturyLink. I mean, that is amazing.
Exactly. It was more than a Seahawks game.
Yeah. So speaking of which, there is a Seahawks game tonight. Do you want to predict what the score is going to be? No pressure.
I know. Here's the thing. When we did our score predictions on Friday's show, Tom and Jake were together on this one. They took the Seahawks to win by like just a couple points, close game. I think the Seahawks are going to lose this one, and I would love to be pleasantly surprised.
Good for you for taking a stance. Why do you think that?
San Francisco is just the better team overall. Their defense is playing lights out. They're the top-ranked defense in the league. Seattle's strength right now is Russell Wilson and its offense. And unfortunately for them, San Francisco's strength is shutting that down. And they've limited opposing quarterbacks to only 7 touchdowns. They have more interceptions than they've allowed passing touchdowns from quarterbacks. So it's going to be really, really tough. You're on the road. I would love to see Seattle pull this out. I don't think it's impossible by any means. But I think that if I were to bet on it, I would bet San Francisco. Sorry. Don't hate me.
Richard Sherman, a big part of those interceptions. Seems like we're always talking about how to, how Richard Sherman is going to mess with us. But how do we mess with Richard Sherman?
I don't think you can. It's impossible.
Oh, come on. Get creative.
No, I mean, maybe tell him. He's been tweeting all about how Christmas music, he's so excited that he's just completely ignoring Thanksgiving. He's like, it's Christmas time. I'm listening to music. I've got the tree up. I guess maybe troll him for that. Maybe you have just so many Thanksgiving themed things or start hating on Christmas starting way too early. I don't know. I think that's the only approach. I think that's what you have to do.
I feel like he gets distracted when people doubt him. Is there something, is there a way to sort of just jab him a little bit and get him excited about that?
The tough thing about Richard Sherman, and it's what makes opposing fans hate him and fans of his team love him, is that all of that just makes him stronger.
Yeah, you're right.
Like he soaks it up like a sponge, and then he espouses it to get the team really riled up.
Just ignore him.
Mm.
That's the trick, really.
Now, you guys are filibustering here. What's the score going to be? Seahawks are going to lose by what score, Stacey?
Oh, no.
Let's go.
What are you doing? Okay. I'm going to say it's going to be 17 Seahawks, 31 49ers.
Okay.
Why not?
Wow.
You got that, James?
That hurts.
Okay, we have the recording, and we'll see. If you're right, that will be somewhat redemptive. But if you're wrong,
I would love to be wrong and just to play it back tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks.
Veterans Day, and the question that comes up from time to time, what happens when the troops come home? And typically that depends on the war they were fighting. Many companies have policies and procedures to make sure they hire veterans, but sometimes they find themselves, veterans do, in the underemployed category. CBS military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland joins us live. I saw a statistic that I found pretty disturbing, that the latest count, and this is done by the National Coalition of Homeless Veterans, found that on any given night, there are more than 40,000 homeless veterans around the country, which just doesn't seem right. Is the Veterans Administration doing its job to help people when they come home?
Well, the Veterans Administration certainly tries to help them out, and they take care of or give possible treatment in some form to about half of all veterans. About 9 million veterans seek some kind of Veterans Affairs assistance. But you're right, Dave, this is an endemic problem. Why it's the case, I have not yet seen anyone who's been able to give a definitive answer to that. Some suggest perhaps PTSD. Some suggest, you know, problems of social readjustment coming back from being in the service. But I know particularly in a place like Seattle where you have a significant homeless problem, that certainly is the case, and as well as other issues, of course, of like rising cost of housing. But it certainly does seem that that many veterans is somewhat of a national disgrace, and it also appears that as a percentage of the population, veterans who are homeless are slightly higher than those who did not serve military at any time in their life.
It was just a few years ago we were talking about the wait times associated with the VA just to get help. Has that been alleviated any by the Trump administration and funding?
It's been improved. Whether it's been alleviated or not, I think is still an open question. There's been a lot of talk about opening up, and there's laws have been changed to allow veterans to seek medical attention in their private communities and use, you know, sort of the Veterans Affairs to pay for that as opposed to going to a veterans facility, which opens things up for a lot of veterans who perhaps don't live in close proximity to a veterans hospital. But at the same time, you know, as we beat up on the VA, and when they fail, well, they certainly should be beat up on. I got to tell you, from my experience as a veteran, every time I've gone into a veterans hospital, and it's fascinating, as you sit in the waiting room and you look around the room and you realize that you got two or three Vietnam veterans over there, maybe even one old World War II, a Korean War veteran, a couple guys from the Gulf War, and, you know, and a guy or two from the current war on terrorism, that you've got this sort of, you know, demography of veterans sitting in that same room. That the care I've seen has always been tremendous and a real positive attitude. So while we beat up on the VA, I think every once in a while, and perhaps Veterans Day is a good day, we should thank them for their service as well.
Yeah, absolutely. PTSD, which, as you mentioned, there's been obviously a concerted effort to remove the stigma from that. Is that working? Is it now considered completely normal for someone who suffers the after effects of battle to say, Doc, I need help with this? Or is it still considered to be a sign of weakness?
No, I think it still is. And that's more of a social than a uniquely military aspect. I mean, we still have, I think, in the United States, particularly for males, young males, sort of the attitude that, you know, big boys don't cry. You don't show your feelings in public. You suck it up. You move on. We hear an awful lot of that perhaps in athletics, and that transfers into their attitudes when they don a uniform. So that's one of those continuing education things, Dave, that I think we have to do more and more about. And we also have to recognize that we have veterans now coming back from multiple tours. This is war in Afghanistan now, the longest war in our history, going on for over 19 years. And we also have a much higher percentage of our veteran population are female. When I was a youngster back in 1968 and joined the military, very tiny percentage of population, veteran population and serving population were female. Now about 10% are female, and that changes the constellation somewhat as well.
What's the most meaningful thing you can say to a veteran today, but really any day, but today especially?
Well, the common phrase, of course, is thank you for your service, and that's nice, and I think most veterans appreciate that. I think some of them find it, and perhaps Veterans Day is a good day to bring this up, somewhat superficial, sort of like, you know, have a nice day. Mm-hmm. So in particular on a Veterans Day, if you actually encounter a veteran, what I would encourage those listening to say that to them, perhaps, and then say, you know, tell me about your service. Where did you serve? Where did you go? Tell me about it so I can appreciate what you have been through a little bit more. So I would urge people to perhaps take on Veterans Day that extra step of not just saying thank you for service and moving on, but take that extra step to actually get to know that veteran, get to know what happened to him. And from doing so, I think you'll have a greater appreciation for the service they have rendered.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, retired Army colonel. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.